This is Christy, and we have merchandise. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com and check out amazing t-shirts, mugs, stickers. If you love great quotes, we have some of our favorites. If you love silliness, check out our mascot, Brain Man. Go to howtolovelitpodcast.com, clip on the shop button, and find something for that person who needs to be reminded that we are fashion creatures but half made up. Mary Shelley said that.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Christy Shriver, and we're here to discuss books that have changed the world and have changed us.
And I'm Gary Shriver, and this is the How to Love It podcast. In 1572, on Bread Street in the city of London, a well-educated Roman Catholic woman, Elizabeth Heywood, gave birth to John Donne. She didn't know it, obviously, but her son would grow up to become a revered poet, but also one of the greatest preachers in Anglican history. His life story inspired some of the best love poetry and some of the most interesting religious thoughts in the English language. The experiences and ideas that shaped him spring from his Catholic roots. Being born Catholic in 1572 meant being born into one of the most religiously difficult periods of English history. And the Donne family, despite having relatively well-to-do or being relatively well-to-do, was not immune to the intense persecution of the era. 40 years before John's birth, Elizabeth's great-uncle and author of Utopia, Sir Thomas More, was executed, although arguably regretfully by Henry VIII for his beliefs. But Sir Thomas More would not be the only relative of John Donne to perish for his faith. Over the course of his life, John Donne watched 11 other family members die a martyr's death, including his brother, Henry Donne, who was caught harboring a Catholic priest in his room. And Henry was sent to prison where he died of cholera. And for the Donne family, as with all devout Catholics of the time period, being willing to live a sacrificial life was the expectation and not the exception.
And yet, you know, despite all of that, John Donne eventually left the Catholic Church for the Anglican Church. You just wouldn't think something like that was possible. And Donne was a deep man of faith, and he disagreed with some aspects of Catholic distinctions, I mean, such as celibacy of the clergy or transubstantiation. And he found common ground between the two branches of Christianity that were warring really during his lifetime. Things that are fundamental to what it meant to be a Christian, such as the belief in the Trinity. He was not a proponent of violent religious factions. And in fact, in his first sermon as dean, he openly preached against the violence in the Christian world, claiming it was a sad contemplation to watch Christians scratch and tear one another. Those were his words. He believed in finding a middle way and allowing people to live in disagreement, but in peace. It was something he lived, and he preached it as well. In fact, his mother, who died a Catholic, kept images of Mary in the home that she shared with her Anglican son, something he didn't necessarily agree with himself, but he permitted. His life and his poetry express a journey of spiritual struggles, an understanding of the complexity of faith, the paradoxes that are contained within sacred text. They're often the writings of an outsider, someone from a minority faith. He wasn't a courtier of the court, as many poets were. And Donne's writings express a man who does not overly simplify difficult religious or social tensions. He engages faith. He rebels against faith, but ultimately he died a man of great faith, having confronted the plague 3 times just while serving as dean. At the time of Donne's death, he was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, where he had preached to thousands, including a sermon in front of King Charles just weeks before his own death in 1631. A sermon that many consider to be his own funeral sermon, and it was titled Death's Duel.
John Donne talks a lot about death, and in fact, he's famous for it.
Well, he does, but he also talks a lot about love, and he's famous for that, too. He's famous for his insights about both of these big ideas. I mean, he experienced both emotions very deeply and intensely, and he wrote about them that way. Sometimes he's so intense that he's difficult to understand. Other times he can be funny, even to us hundreds of years later. Donne writes, even in his short poems, in these weird, complicated arguments, he makes awkward and unlikely comparisons, and some of them take quite a bit of thinking to work out. In fact, Ben Jonson, who was his contemporary, although liked his work and considered himself a fan, predicted Donne's poetry would perish, and this is what he said, for want of being understood. He described Donne's poetry as just being too intellectual and too strange for most people. Jonson put it this way, Donne, the delight of Phoebus, and that's just another word for Apollo, but Donne, the delight of Phoebus, and each must too to thine one all other brains refuse.
So basically, you have to be a Greek god to understand him.
Yeah, I think that's what Jonson thought. And really kind of, I agree with him. I mean, Donne is hard to understand. And there's a lot of material to understand if you really want to get into his work. I mean, we have about today 9,100 lines of his poetry that have been preserved. And ironically, of those, which many, many lines of poetry, he only published 2 poems during his entire life.
Well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, so if he didn't publish them, how did they get around?
Well, they were manuscripts, and they circulated among his friends and then just kind of got out that way. I mean, in those days, it wasn't really considered dignified to publish your work. I will say that 6 other poems of his were published during his life by someone else, but they weren't published with his permission. So anything that we have was first made public through this manuscript system. They were written down in his life and circulated, but they were only published after his death. But besides his poetry, there's 160 of his sermons that we have. And besides the sermons that the poetry and the sermons that we're familiar with, there's other things too, like essays and treatises on religion, and there's meditations on illness. There's 230 letters.
You know, most of his work is religious, which shouldn't be surprising. And his most popular poems today, though they are not his religious poems, but they're secular ones, and they are secular and somewhat promiscuous. Odd combination.
I know, for a preacher. And to be honest, you know, nobody knows exactly when any of these, you know, sketchy poems were written. Most scholars will tell you that his secular poems were likely written before he was 25, but we don't know that. We do know that they weren't written when he was a dean, because there's evidence that point to that. To that in his life. At that point, they were kind of embarrassing for him, and he even tried to limit their circulation. But apparently in the 1600s, manuscripts were like tweets. They just never go away. You know, his secular poetry is fun. It's irreverent. Most of it, or I don't know about most of it, a lot of it is about seducing women, at least the popular stuff is. On the surface, they can come across as misogynistic locker room talks, actually. But for the most part, they're just plain mockery of the courtly love trope that had consumed the social scene of his day. We'll see how biting that mockery can be as we discuss today his most anthologized poem, The Flea.
Well, it's a very interesting idea, because I think most of us, when we read his mocking poems, think he's mocking women, but to think that he's mocking the pervasive attitude towards women and a relationship at court between men and women, that changes how we understand almost all of his mocking poems, and there are a lot of those.
Well, there are. And although I said we don't know when any of them were written, there are a few that must have been written after he fell in love with a girl named Anne, which we'll talk about next episode. But there's an obvious departure from mocking the idea of this perfect woman and seducing her to really being in love and paying any price to be with someone that you do love, which is what his serious love poems were about.
If you judge their relationship by some of his sincere love poems, it's unquestionable that he absolutely and unconditionally adored his wife. I mean, never mind the fact that when Anne died, he quit writing love poetry entirely, and he wrote a whole other sort of poetry after that.
That's true. And he's just an interesting man, and he never stopped being interested in the relationship between physical love and spiritual love. He wrote about these two ideas constantly, and he connected them constantly. He saw them as intertwined, which was very different than what other people were doing or thinking at the time. He wanted to know, how much does the mind matter in participating in love? How much does the body, the soul, the spirit, how is it connected? I mean, in his secular poetry, he expresses ideas about the physical relationship between a man and a woman, but he uses religious metaphors. And as he got older, he seemed to understand that the Christian view of intimacy, even between God, should be seen, experienced, and expressed, and could be expressed using sexual metaphors. Now, you can take this to be offensive, but you shouldn't, because if you do, you won't understand his understanding. He takes more seriously than most Christians the imagery of biblical texts that God uses to describe his relationship with humanity. And he takes note that when the Bible speaks about God's relationship with humanity, he has done so in sexual terms. I mean, most Christians don't think about it, but it's true. In the Old Testament, the most obvious example being in the book of Song of Solomon's. I mean, for example, Song of Solomon 6:3 says, "I am my beloved and my beloved is mine." But it's just as true in the New Testament, where God's people are constantly being referenced as the bride of Christ. I mean, it's very unusual. You know, these are unusual choices for sure for religious diction, but it's clear that it caught Dunn's attention and he thought about it quite a bit. It shows up in almost all of his famous pieces, both his religious pieces and we see it in his secular ones.
Well, before we introduce that most famous piece and many people's favorite, The Flea, let's start with some operational definitions. You know how I like that. He's called a metaphysical poet, but that term metaphysical is used to mean something very specific. He's not the only metaphysical poet, but he is certainly the most well-known. And what is a metaphysical poet? That term wasn't a term that existed during his lifetime. There was no group of poets during that time period that called themselves the metaphysical poets.
No, you're right. And the term metaphysical poetry didn't show up for almost 100 years after anyone who we call that today even lived. A man by the name of John Dryden made it up, and the critic Samuel Johnson used it and made it famous. But he didn't do so because he wanted to honor the poets. He used that term to denigrate them. He called Dunn's work specifically the most heterogeneous ideas yoked by violence together. I mean, he said medical physical poetry was where, and let me quote him, "nature and art are ransacked for illustrations, comparisons, and allusions." And he said, "it took a lot of effort to read, but seldom is the effort pleased."
I guess that means he did not approve.
And, no.
And what was it that he hated so much about it?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, he hated their style of writing. I mean, he said specifically that it was just too conversational. The metaphors, they were too far-fetched. He didn't like that it was argumentative. And of course, these are all true things. It is those things. The poems don't have the cadence of the poetry of the time. They sounded more like how people talked than any kind of regular meter you would expect in, say, like a Shakespearean sonnet. For Dunn and the other medical physical poets, wit was the most important consideration. They wanted their poems to be clever. They also wanted them to be rhetorical, But sometimes the rhetoric was obviously flawed, and the logical fallacies were meant to entertain the reader. And their style, by the way, it was popular among their friends, but as a literary style, it was not popular. I mean, I have an English textbook from the 1890s, and John Donne isn't even in it. That all changed, though, when T.S. Eliot rediscovered them in the early 1900s, because T.S. Eliot changed the world's mind. Samuel Johnson hated it. Eliot loved the exact same things that Johnson hated, and he taught us to love it. He wrote a famous essay called The Metaphysical Poets. And Eliot didn't disagree with any of Johnson's observations. He agreed their rhythm was strange, as were their metaphors. But instead of disliking that style, he liked it. What had been offensive was now something to copy. Donne, all of a sudden, was a precursor to modernism.
What goes around comes around. And I would like to point out, in John Donne's day, and remind everybody that poetry was considered the most elevated style of writing. If you wrote novels, that was low class. Poetry was the highest of skills when it came to wordsmithing that in that time period. You know, so what characteristics make metaphysical poetry different from other types of poetry?
Well, for one thing, they were borrowing a lot of the conventions of the theater and putting them in poems. That's why they're conversational. They're meant to sound like one-sided conversations. And if you remember, this is the great age of the Elizabethan theater, and it's the theater's influence on poetry that we notice. This is the era of Shakespeare. I mean, Donne is 8 years younger than Shakespeare, and Donne, like most people, loved the theater.
Oh, you know, were they friends? Were they acquaintances?
You know, I don't know of any evidence to suggest that. I mean, maybe they did. I mean, they lived in the same town at the same time. It's clear Shakespeare, among the other famous playwrights, is leaving his mark. For example, this poem that we're going to talk about, The Flea, you know, it's a dramatic monologue. But back to the question, your original question, what are the characteristics that make someone a metaphysical poet? Well, if I were going to pick one overarching requirement, I've said it before, I'll say it again, the poems must be witty. That's the word they used to describe their work at the time, and it's the word we're still using. These poems have to be worked out. They're not just descriptions of landscapes or declarations of love to an unattainable muse. They appeal to the intellect, and they can be funny. They aspire to be. They aspire to be full of paradox, and that's even for the unfunny ones. It means that when you read a metaphysical poem, what he's saying shouldn't make sense at the first pass. So you're supposed to think about it and read it through a second or a third, maybe a fourth time, thinking through the comparisons, looking at how the logic works. There's an argument being made, an attempt to persuasion, even if the poet is being facetious, which they often are. Let me give you an example of what I mean by full of paradox or rhetorical. Instead of reading the poem, though, because I want to make the point without getting bogged down in the old-fashioned English. I want to translate it to kind of the way we talk the modern English, so the syntactical problems don't keep us from understanding the poem. It's an excerpt from a funny poem called The Curse. And in the poem, Donne is clearly mad, and the poem is a curse on the man that he's angry with. So listen to what he says. May he win only love that he has to pay cash for, but may the woman he pays be an idiot. And then may she cheat on him, but only with people he hates, presumably a large number of people. And may he regret that he ever have gotten involved with her, not because he regrets his immorality, but because the reputation of the woman he's involved with is so bad that he's gotten to become the butt of everyone's joke for being with her physically. This curse goes on and on, by the way, for four stanzas, to which he concludes with this awfully chauvinistic line, for which he says something like this. And oh, if it turns out that this person that I hate is not a man at all, but a woman, then let all these curses I take back, because nature has just out-cursed me.
I'm surprised you like that, because that is definitely chauvinistic.
Well, true, and I thought Donne was being really chauvinistic and that he felt that way about women. But if I did, I wouldn't find it funny. But I don't think he's expressing his view of women. He's presuming that the guy being cursed feels that way about women, not him. So, you know, that's the thing about these metaphysical, physical poets, or really maybe even all great poets. You can't assume that the views of the persona of the poem are necessarily the views of the poet. Sometimes they are, but sometimes, especially if the poem is mock serious, they're just not. And in the case of the medical physical poems, often they're just being witty. Witty is the goal. So with these metaphysical poems, it's a game, and the best wit wins.
So characteristic number one, metaphysical poets are witty. Characteristic number two, they're making arguments, and sometimes the arguments are ridiculous, but that is part of the game. But what we will see is that in Donne's case, his poetry gets more serious, presumably as he gets older, and the arguments become not games of wit, but really serious discussions about the nature of God and the nature of life and the nature of death and the nature of religion.
That's true, and let me bring up one more characteristic, metaphysical. I know I've said medical, but that's a slip of my tongue. Metaphysical poets use aggressive language. They've been described as fierce, borderline offensive. They talk in the second person. They don't necessarily follow expected rhyme schemes. They called their language strong lines. Masculine expression. Those aren't my expressions. That's how they talked about it.
Well, and again, that term seems difficult to understand. I mean, what do you consider aggressive language or what they call masculine expression? I guess attacking with words?
Kinda. It means they just say things. And sometimes other people wouldn't say those sorts of things. I mean, here's an example. This comes out of Donne's poem, The Damp. And he imagines in this poem his own death, which is that in itself is kind of dark and not something other poets haven't done, though. However, Donne takes it farther than most poets would. In his poem, he follows up his death with his friends getting a doctor to perform an autopsy. And the poem accompanies the autopsy as the doctor takes apart the speaker's body with his friends watching. When the doctor gets to the heart, they find a picture of his lover inside. And the lover's picture shoots poisonous vapor and murders them. I mean, these are strong lines. I mean, in this case, the violence is kind of outrageous. It's overdone and it's a little funny. But you're also left wondering, why? What on earth does he mean? I mean, he's talking about love, about death, about a woman. I mean, you really do have to read it several times to sort of sort it out and put the confusing pictures together.
Well, one specific term we think of when we think of metaphysical poets is the term conceit. Let's talk about that. What is a conceit?
Yeah, the word conceit. Now, it's connected with another word that we know better, the word concept. And a metaphysical conceit is when you explore a concept by making a comparison that on its surface is extreme, far-fetched, maybe makes no sense at all without a kind of explanation, kind of like The Damp, the poem we just referenced. But it's the poet's job to make the comparison work like a puzzle or a riddle. So we're supposed to see the intelligent humor, and then we can understand the rhetoric. But it may be aggressive, and it may be dramatic. And these are the things that at first pass may not make sense to us. Henceforth, welcome to metaphysical poetry.
Of which John Donne is the biggest name. But let's get back to Donne's life story, which is just as interesting as some of these poems. And in fact, it really helps make sense of them. Although I know we're not supposed to read biography into everything, you know, it's impossible not to notice how one influences the other. And for example, as a little child, Donne was educated by an uncle who was a Jesuit priest, which was likely a terrifying prospect because, remember, every Catholic child was constantly aware that his faith was illegal and punishable by death. And in fact, Donne himself was taken to public executions and taught about the importance of sacrifice and martyrdom. And so there's that influence that left a profound imprint on his psychology. And we can see that when we look at his writing. But there's also the undeniable fact that he was brilliant and people knew it. At age 11, he was sent to Hart Hall in Oxford for 3 years and then to Cambridge for another 3 years. But even there was always the problem of religion. He was Catholic and he wouldn't subscribe to the 39 articles, and so he couldn't get a degree. And instead, he left and he went to London, to Lincoln's Inn, to study law and languages. And of course, you know, that seems to have gone well. And he mingled and befriended many well-connected people, and it was from there that he left to travel the world. And in 1596 and 1597, he joined a couple of expeditions, first to Spain and then to the Azores. And we might could say those were his wild years. He spent his inheritance on wine and women, as one biographer noted, and it was also during those years that he likely wrote a lot of poetry that he's famous for today. And none of it was published, of course, but the manuscripts were around for his friends. And they were witty and they became very popular. And I do want to point out that his poems are not dated, and there's been lots of speculation as to who they were about when they were written, what were the circumstances for any particular poem, none of which we really know. We do know that, and speaking about, we call his mocking poems, the ones that are funny and irreverent, and there are a lot of them, he wrote them to entertain, and apparently they did. He was entertaining. During those years, he moved up in the social ranks, and eventually, in 1598, he received an appointment to become the secretary of Sir Thomas Egerton, one of the highest officials in Queen Elizabeth's court, and, you know, that was kind of a big deal.
Right, and the first poem we're going to read is called, like I said, The Flea. It may be his most popular poem. It's certainly one of his most, if not his most, anthologized. I mean, the entire poem is meant to be a joke. It attacks and it mocks the courtly traditions that were the fashionable cliches of the day. But Gary, let's talk about that. We've all heard of courtly love, but let's have an operational definition.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was just a weird anomaly of culture at the time. You know, courtly love practices in the English courts started well before John Donne, of course, and really sometime in the 1300s. But they were still in practice during Donne's day. And most of us have seen some version of this in the Elizabethan movies or shows like Rain or Versailles. And it started really as a literary practice. And if you listen to our episode on Petrarch, he really popularized the love sonnet, which means little song. And the big idea behind it is this understanding that marriage had nothing to do with love. Marriage was political and economic, and courtly love was a way for nobles to find romance and love outside of marriage. And this wasn't really frowned upon, you know, if chastity and fidelity were adhered to, which they may or may not have been. In fact, it was often not adhered to.
I would assume.
But regardless, there was a code of chivalry that everyone was expected to follow. And the code allowed knights and ladies to show admiration for each other in spite of marriage. I mean, there were rules. In fact, at one point, rules were codified by a man by the name of Andreas Capellanus. Here's a couple of them. Every lover regularly turns pale in the presence of his beloved.
Nice.
Or he whom the thought of love vexes eats and sleeps very little. You know, in the courtly love tradition, the lover exists to serve a lady, and that lady was to be worshipped, and she was completely objectified. She was idealized, and the lover would pledge loyalty to her. He would claim that if she didn't sleep with him, he would physically die. And I want to point out that courtly love is in direct conflict with the teachings of the Christian church on love and marriage, and that was also a part of the culture, so there is that inconsistency. But what we see in Donne is a reaction to the courtly love tradition. Even in the secular poetry, he is mocking it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Donne's position, because I think it's important to note that Donne isn't an advocate of the courtly tradition. He mocks it in a lot of his poetry, and he's certainly mocking it in the one where the lover in this poem makes courtly love claims, and Donne makes them appear ridiculous. So this poem is a mockery of this idea that a man will just say about anything to get a woman to sleep with him. And he does this with the use of a metaphysical conceit. He compares having sex with a woman to getting bitten by the same flea as a woman. I mean, obviously, That's pretty awkward. Intentionally ridiculous. I mean, fleas are one of the most vile and yet common pests he could have chosen. And although he wasn't the first to compare having sex to getting bitten by a flea, he's certainly the one that made the comparison famous. And he takes it farther than anyone ever had before him. I mean, in this poem, a flea is compared to sex, to marriage, and eventually to a religious experience with Jesus. I mean, it's ludicrous to the level of heretical if you take it seriously. Obviously, the logic is fallacious. It's not sound. It's not valid. But like every good logical fallacy, it's meant to look sound and valid. And that's what we mean when we say it's witty. If you understand the logic, it appears to be sound, and that's the joke. It's intelligent humor, as intelligent humor always is. And it seems clear, even from the context of the poem, that the woman he was, quote unquote, seducing was never fooled. Perhaps she enjoyed the joke herself, a smart girl. This poem was never actually meant to be a successful tool for seduction, at least not in the obvious sense in which it was written. Maybe if you like wit. So let's give it a go. Let's read it.
Mark but this flea, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee, and in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said, a sin nor shame nor loss of maidenhead. Yet this enjoys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two. And this, alas, is more than we would do.
So let's think about this in terms of the structure. In one sense, this is structured like a sermon. In those days, and really today, we see a lot of this too, but sermons start with object lessons. I mean, even in the Bible, you see Jesus saying, look at the lilies of the field. Notice the mustard seeds. It's that kind of language. Mark the flea. Mark but this flea. He's saying, look at the flea. Look how a small thing you're denying me. The flea sucked my blood, then it sucked your blood. Our fluids are already mingled inside the body of a flea. This isn't a sin or something to be ashamed of. It's not a big deal. It doesn't mean you've lost your virginity to the flea, and yet it enjoys the essence of our mingled fluids. I mean, there's a lot of sexual innuendo in the language, but if you read it one more time, you'll pick it up and you can feel the funny of it.
Mark but this flea, and mark in this, how little thou which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee, and in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said, a sin nor shame nor loss of maidenhead. Yet this enjoys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two, and this, alas, is more than we would do.
So that's stanza one. But in stanza two, the drama will continue as if this were a kind of mini play. The flea has bitten both the man and the woman. The woman, though, doesn't buy the ridiculous argument. That's not in the poem, but she's clearly not seduced because between stanza one and stanza two, she lifts her hand to kill the flea. And he's going to ask her to stay her hand. That means hold back your hand. In other words, don't kill the flea. Then he's going to make a second argument, another argument about why she shouldn't kill the flea.
Oh, stay, three lives and one flea spare, where we almost, nay, more than married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed and marriage temple is. Though parents grudge and you were met and cloistered in these living walls of jet, though use make you apt to kill me, let not to that self-murder added be and sacrilege three sins in killing thee.
So listen to how awkward. If it wasn't awkward in stanza one, it just got worse because now he's comparing the flea to our marriage bed. He's going to say we are more than married because our blood is already mixed. In fact, the flea is not just a marriage bed. It's a marriage temple. Here's the religious language. Of course, marriage is a sacrament. It's holy before God. So this is kind of bordering sacrilegious. He uses the word cloistered. That's another religious word to say, well, they've basically already had sex within the body of the flea. He tells her she can't kill the flea because it would be like killing him, killing herself, and killing the flea. And of course, you go to hell for those things. This line, though use make you apt to kill me, means I know you're used to killing me. And he's leaning on that courtly love tradition that a man dies if the woman won't have sex with him. But he's saying, I know you don't mind killing me, but if you kill the flea, that's a different kind of sin. Your blood is in the flea. That's suicide. And then consider the flea. It has its own life. It's three murders.
You know, he has reached the epitome of ridiculous in this logic right here. Yeah, I guess if you understood at the time, you'd be going, this story's so ridiculous, I've got to stick around and see how it ends.
And we have another stanza, because it is, and clearly the woman doesn't buy it, because between the second and the third stanza, she kills the flea cruelly, if you use the words of the lover. She has purpled her nail with blood of innocence. Again, notice the religious language. He's going farther than most men would dare to go. Blood of innocence? I mean, that's the reference to the crucifixion of Jesus. Listen for it. Whose innocent blood was shed for the salvation of all mankind. He's taking this metaphysical conceit to a whole nother level.
Cruel and sudden, thou hast since purpled thy nail in the blood of innocence. Wherein could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Yet thou triumphst, and say that thou findest not thyself, nor me, the weaker now. 'Tis true, then learn how false fears be. Just so much honor, when thou yield'st to me, will waste as this flea's death took life from thee.
And just when you thought how much more ridiculous it could not get, it goes there. Because now we have another twist of logic. So the woman has killed the flea, proving that nothing spiritual or eternal happens when you murder or kill the flea that has bitten two different people. But the speaker, knowing that this is probably what she would do, is prepared to switch the logic on her. So he says, well, there you go. Nothing happened from those two bloods mingling. See? Nothing will happen when we mingle our bloods. There's nothing to be afraid of. And of course, listen to the last line. It's so cocky. He says, 'Tis true. Learn how false fears be. Just so much honor when thou yield'st to me. He doesn't say if you'll yield to me. He says when you yield to me.
You know, in other words, he's saying, I'm just that irresistible. Sooner or later, you're sleeping with me.
Exactly.
Is there a part two of this poem? I mean, do we know what the woman does next?
Well, no. That's the short answer. There are many critical essays, if you can believe it, where they argue different points. But here's my thinking. She doesn't sleep with him. She's clearly smart. He's tried to seduce her before. He's admitted to as such and failed. She kills the insect, laughs in his face. She's holding out for a better offer. And this offer is not coming from the dude who tries to seduce a woman with nothing but a flea.
Well, fair enough. You know, and truthfully, the poem was written for men and may have been more for male bonding in a bar than actually trying to seduce a woman. We do know that there was a woman in Dunn's life who did turn his world upside down. You know, Dunn meeting and marrying Anne Moore introduced him to a new kind of love and a new kind of love poetry unlike anything this world of courtly love had ever seen before.
Because there are so many problems with dating Dunn's work, we don't know when he started writing this new style of love poetry, or even for sure if it was all for Anne. But we do know for sure that this new style of love poetry is powerful and startling. And we're going to see that writing about meaningful love, meaningful sex, had never been done before. Not like Dunn was going to do it. Dunn writes about love between two people that's so intimate it could only be described as holy.
You know, it sounds to me like he is shocking the world with authenticity. Wow, yeah. What a novel idea. You know, and it's that kind of love poetry that we will discuss in the next episode, where we will delve into his relationship with Anne and the poetry that goes with it. And between now and then, we hope that you enjoyed this introduction to John Donne and metaphysical poetry. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can always find us at howtolovelitpodcast.com, where we have links to all of our over 250 episodes now, and listening guides for most of them, as well as other teaching resources. Also, whether you're a teacher, a student, a fellow lover of literature, please subscribe to our podcast via YouTube, Apple, Spotify, etc. Give us a rating, and if you like what you hear, possibly a review. It's when you share about the podcast to your friends on social media that we grow. Thank you for supporting us in our mission to make reading great literature accessible and enjoyable to as many people as possible.
Peace out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.